How are you guys doing today? Mostly awake. I know it's cloudy outside. It's so easy to sleep. And so what I'm about to do is going to be a little bit risky, but we're going to try it anyhow. I'm going to invite all of you to close your eyes for a minute. This is not an invitation to nap time, all right? I'm going to check that you open them back up when we're done. Trust me. Close your eyes. Take a deep breath in. Out. What I want you to do in this moment is take yourself back to a time in your life when you were really, really happy. It was just right. I mean, life was good. You had peace. Had joy. There was no anxiety, no fear. You were just really happy and content. I want you to hold that in your mind for a moment. You can open your eyes. What would it take to get you back there? And I'm not talking about going back in time. I'm not talking about trying to recreate old experiences. But I'm talking about that peace and that joy and that contentment and that happiness. What would it take to get you to that again? Is there a place in life where that sort of experience is in fact the norm and not the exception, where you actually have joy even though life doesn't always go the way you want, right? Because that's going to happen. A place where you actually have peace amidst the storms that inevitably come. Is there a place where we could really be happy? Because it is what we want, is it not? I mean, I don't think anybody in this room is going to be like, nah, I don't want to be happy. It's what we want, right? Blaise Pascal says, all men seek happiness, and this is without exception. Whatever different means they employ, they all tend to this end. The cause of some going to war and of others avoiding it is the same desire in both, attended with different views. The will never takes the least step but to this object. This is the motive of every action of every man, even those who end their own life. Everything we do is aimed at the object of happiness. We're trying to get there to this ideal state of being. And all of our choices, I think, are built around that. And you may say, well, wait a minute, I've made a lot of choices that I didn't like in life. Sure, I get that. Maybe you don't like your choices, but of all the options that you had, you picked the one that you thought would bring you the most happiness because you liked all the other options a lot less. We really want to be happy. I think you could understand this by just observing human behavior. Or you could learn it by going to Scripture. Because in fact, the Bible has a lot to say about what is necessary to be happy. And until we understand that, we're really liable to misunderstand so much of Scripture, especially the Old Testament. A lot of us think that the Torah, the instruction, the laws of the Old Testament are, well, we read them and they just seem to us to be somewhat arbitrary, maybe somewhat archaic, out of date, and it just seems like an arbitrary God making arbitrary rules because he can and he likes to be in charge and boss people around. But if that's the way we think about the law, man, we've missed it. We've not actually heard what Scripture itself tells us about the law and the instructions, because what Scripture tells us is very, very clear. God gives the law and the instructions and all of his commandments to help us live a happy life. The good life. Don't miss this. This is so important. They're the sort of commands and instructions about what you can do and what you can't do, because it's part of this promise for God to come live with you. And so you don't do these things, you do these things, but all of it within the framework of God is living with us. Like he's in our presence, he's all around us, and because God is with us, it is a really, really good life. Follow these instructions, you get to the good life. What's the history of Israel? We've just gone through a huge series about the story of salvation. And if you tracked along in that, you know that early history of Israel is they just completely failed to do this. They didn't do what God said, and it never went well for them. And they weren't happy. They were carried off into exile. And what's amazing is that God brings them back. And when they come back from exile, man, it's like a switch got flipped. All of a sudden they get it, and they get really, really earnest about following God's law. They're like, all right, we got it. We have to follow this law so we can be in right relationship with God, because that's the sweet spot. That's where life is good, and that's where we can be really, really happy. But watch how complicated this gets, because they go to the Old Testament, they're reading the rules, and there's always the how-to question. Right? God says, honor the Sabbath. Don't work on the Sabbath. And they say, okay, we want to do that. But what does it mean in practice? What counts as work? What's acceptable and unacceptable? I mean, you just lay in bed the whole Sabbath and afraid to move? Well, no, that doesn't work. So what counts? And so the more Israel gets serious about this, especially as we get close to the time of the New Testament, what we have is the commands that God has given in the Old Testament, and then on top of that is this really thick layer of interpretation. It's how you follow all the rules, and there's more rules, and rules on top of rules, and the exceptions to rules, and what days the rules apply and what days they don't, and it gets very, very complicated, and then all of a sudden you have different religious leaders that disagree on the interpretation of the law and the application of the rules. And so by the time you get to Jesus, somebody finally said, look, you got to make this simple for me. I want to be happy. I want to live the good life. I want to live with God. But man, I cannot memorize hundreds and hundreds of rules and remember what days they apply and what days they don't. Boil it down to something I can live with. What is the essence of the instruction of God that leads to the good life? Three times in the Synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, this question is brought up. And in all three times, the Shema is quoted. The Shema is a statement of faith from the Old Testament. Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. So love him with all of your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all of your strength. This, Jesus tells us, is the first and greatest commandment. But wait, the second is just like it. You better love your neighbor the same way you love yourself. This is the answer, right? How do I be happy? How do I follow the instructions that lead to relationship with God and keep me happy? If you want to be happy, it has to do with how you love. If you want to be happy, it has to do with how you love. Love God with all your heart, all your soul, all your mind, all your strength, everything. Love your neighbor as yourself. And as I thought about that this week, I thought about what I would think if I was sitting where you're sitting. Because many of you have grown up in the church, right? I did. And if I was sitting there, my thought process would be, oh, sweet mercy, not another sermon on love. I mean, church is a great place to be honest. Who's heard the love sermon before, right? How many of you have heard it 10 times? 20? I mean, sweet mercy, we've heard this, haven't we? Over and over and over again, the pastor tells you, gotta love, gotta love, gotta love. It's like we're numb to it. Right? I get it already. Love God, got it. Love your neighbor, got it. Love your enemy, got it. Love your spouse, got it. We get it, right? We've heard this over and over and over again. Here's my question, though. If we got it, then why aren't we happier than what we are? if love is the way we get to happiness, and we got it, why are we not happier than what we are? Because nobody in this room is going to say, oh, I don't love God. And I wouldn't believe it if you said, I think everybody in this room on some level loves God. We love our neighbor and our spouses. It's not a deficiency of love. We have it. We have love. But if we're still not really happy, then there must be a problem. And here's what I think the problem is. It's not that we fail to have love. It's that our love is disordered. It's out of alignment. It's out of sync. It's disproportional. This idea that we all have love, but that our love tends to be disordered, is one of the greatest contributions from St. Augustine. St. Augustine was a bishop in a city called Hippo in what we call today Algeria, northern Africa. And he lived from about 350 to 430, so about 300 to 400 years after the time of Christ. And if you don't really know anything about Augustine, you need to understand this. The man was an intellectual giant. I mean, the dude had more brain power than every person in this room put together. I mean, when they talk about Augustine, his name is mentioned in the same sentence as like Plato and Aristotle. I mean, he was one of the greatest contributors to Western philosophy. And like, that's not all he did. Like, yeah, he was a philosopher and a theologian and a pastor. It would be 800 years. After Augustine died, it would be 800 years until somebody came along that would come even close to the sort of intellectual contribution that he made. But here's what's really amazing about Augustine. It's not that he was just really, really sharp. Because we've all met smart people who have no common sense and are, you know, kind of worthless to practical society. This was not Augustine. He was brilliant, but he was also really deep. It's not just that he was smart, but that he understood the human soul. He had a really deep spiritual experience. So on one hand, he's brilliant, but he walked very closely with God. He understood the heart. Now, before Augustine was Bishop of Hippo, he was Augustine of Tagaste. He grew up with a devoutly Christian mother, but a pagan father. And as he grew older, he kind of followed in his father's footsteps until one day he went off to his education, kind of their version of college, and he really enjoyed the party life. I mean, he enjoyed parties, and he enjoyed alcohol, and he enjoyed women. And when they didn't have to be in school, him and his friends were sneaking off to the shady side of town, and they would enjoy the more illicit forms of Roman entertainment, and they were rebellious. I mean, basically, he would have fit into our culture really well. They were very rebellious. They liked breaking rules to break rules. They'd steal stuff they didn't even want. They wouldn't even keep it. They just wanted to steal stuff. How in the world does a young man like that become Bishop of Hippo? How does a young man like that become an intellectual pillar of the church? Well, a couple things happened to him. First, by hard experience, he discovered that trying to find happiness in the pursuit of pleasure is a dead-end road. It doesn't lead anywhere, and it doesn't satisfy. Second, he had a radical conversion experience. God really got a hold of his heart. And so a man that had totally given himself to the pursuit of pleasure now totally gave himself to the pursuit of God. And that decision changed everything. And it had a profound impact on the way that Augustine thought about love. See, for us, we typically think of love as almost this unqualified good. I mean, it's almost synonymous, right? Love is good, right? We think that, and we tend to associate love with affection and feelings towards others, and maybe love is this disposition, but this isn't how Augustine thought about love. He actually had a very different sort of definition. He said, love is a force. Love is a force. It's like gravity. It's like power. It's what draws us or compels us to whatever that object of our love is. Whatever we're loving, we are just moving towards it, and it is it's that love that compels us. It's this moral dynamic that compels all of our actions. It's the sum total force that is driving our life. He says this, "My weight is my love, and by it I am carried wheresoever I'm carried." It's moving us. Whatever it's aimed at, it's moving us. But here's the point. That love can be misguided. This powerful force driving us to whatever that object that we love, it can be aimed or pointed at the wrong thing. That's not good. Because whatever it is that we love and however it is that we are loving it, that is giving shape and character to our lives. This is what Augustine says. "For when we ask whether somebody is a good person, we're not asking what he believes. We're not asking what he hopes for, but what he loves." And to a very real extent, it's whatever you love, that's who you are, or at least that is what you are becoming. It's a different way of thinking about love. So on one hand, we have this powerful force, this love that whatever it is we love, we're being driven by it. And on the other hand, we have this desire for happiness. Like that's the end state of being we want to arrive at. And Augustine agreed with this. He says, all persons want to be happy, but don't miss this. No persons are happy who do not have what they want. We all want to be happy, but you will not be happy if you do not have what you want. So that's the rub, isn't it? We have happiness as this end game. It's where we're trying to get to, and love is the engine that's going to get us there. You got the goal and the means. But because we are fallen and broken, our love can be aimed at the wrong thing. It can be pointed in the wrong direction. We can have disordered love. And that's a problem because if it's aimed in the wrong direction, you don't get to happiness, do you? There's an old word for this sort of love. We don't use it anymore. It's cupidity. Cupidity. Amanda asked me this week, she said, "What are you preaching on?" Being the smart aleck, I looked at her and said, "Cupidity." And she gave me the look of, you know, one adult looking at another when they're being a smart aleck. She said, "Is that anything like Cupid? You know, the little naked angel cherub thing at Valentine's Day with the bow and arrow?" I said, "Well, actually, they come from the same word, yeah." And it's not a bad mental picture. Not the naked baby part, but the bow and arrow. The bow and arrow of love. The problem with cupidity is the bow and arrow is aimed at the wrong thing. It's the wrong thing. Cupidity is love aimed at the temporal world, at this world for its own sake and what we can get out of it. The problem with cupidity is that it's always immoderate. It doesn't know right proportions and right measures. Cupidity is always trying to possess in excess. It's always trying to get more for itself. And here's what I have to warn you about. This is the surest path to misery in human life. What Augustine would call the disease of the soul. He describes this diseased soul in what he calls three feelings, three emotions. The first of it is desire. desire, that intense longing for something. Whatever it is you think you love, a better job, a better car, a better house, a better spouse, whatever you think would make you happy, whatever that object of your love is that is just driving you, there's desire there, isn't it? There is intense longing. But hear me, what always goes hand in hand with desire is fear. Because the minute you set something out in front of you and say, if I can only get that, that will make you happy, in the back door sneaks the fear that you won't get it. Even if you think you know, you may not get it. But what's worse is when you do get it, fear doesn't leave. Oh, no, no, no. Even once you possess the very thing that you think will make you happy, fear remains because you fear that you may lose it. Because that's how life works in the temporal world. Everything is temporary. It's passing. It's fading away. So even when you have the very thing you think will make you happy, you worry that you might lose it. That's how life works. So you have desire and its accompanying fear. The second emotion you'll experience is grief. And that grief is that fear realized. And this is inevitable. Either you will not get what you think will make you happy, or it will be forever unattainable, or you will have what you think will make you happy and you will lose it. Because life has no guarantees. We like to imagine and convince ourselves that every day when our loved ones leave and go to work, they're going to come back, but it's not a guarantee, is it? We don't want to talk about it. But the truth is, nothing is secure. You might have a great house and you might have an electrical fire. You might have a great job and the company might go under. And the longer you live, the more grief you will experience from the things that you thought you had, but they slipped through your fingers. And ultimately, the thing you finally lose is yourself. It doesn't matter if you're the object of your love. Ultimately, you can't keep it because you're mortal, same as all the rest of us. And the third thing you feel is baseless joy. What Augustine experienced, what we experience when we really think we're going to get a soul-level satisfaction from the things of this world, and we pursue it, and you get it, and then once you got it, you realize it cannot deliver what it promised. When that is the condition of the human soul, you don't have happiness or peace. Contentment or joy. It's not that we don't have love. We do. We have love. But so often it's aimed at the wrong things. Of course we love God. But so rarely in right measure and right order. We love our neighbors, right? As far as that goes, sure. The problem is it doesn't usually go far enough. Because most of us have not yet loved our neighbor as we actually love ourselves. And most often we love ourselves more than we love God. No one's going to say it in church. Oh, I love God more than anything else in word. But what about in deed? So what's the solution? Well, Augustine offers this. He says, now he is a man of just and holy life who forms an unprejudiced estimation of things and keeps his affections, his loves, also under strict control so that he neither loves what ought not be loved, nor fails to love what he ought to love, nor loves equally which ought to be loved either less or more, nor loves less or more which ought to be loved equally. No sinner is to be loved as a sinner, but every man is to be loved as a man for God's sake. But God is to be loved for his own sake. And if God is to be loved more than any man, each man ought to love God more than himself. What I think most of us need is a metaphysical hierarchy to help us sort these things out. It's not that we don't have love. We got love. It's that it's out of order and disproportionate. Sure, we love God, just not enough. Not enough. And the reason we need this hierarchy is because, listen, church, God has made a wonderful world. It is. It's wonderful. It's beautiful. And there are many, many, many wonderful things in this wonderful world. I know the news doesn't tell you this, but there are many wonderful things in this wonderful world that are proper objects of love. You should love them. Beautiful things. True things. Good things. Things of nature, things of God's creation, other people. All of these are proper objects of love in their right proportion. That's the danger. The danger is when we put the weight of love too much on something that can't deliver what we're looking for. When we do that, what we end up with is love's disappointment. And I think all of us in this room have experienced that. I almost don't want to use this illustration, but man, when God just gives you one, you got to use it, right? Love's disappointment. How many of you love Nebraska football? Listen, that's a word of empathy. I feel for you guys. 0-5. Ouch. But here's the good news. Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit. All right? How disappointed were you really? I mean, of course you're disappointed. Like, it's annoying, it's frustrating, but did it take from your happiness? I mean, not just kind of that surface level, like, oh, I'm not happy they lost again, but deep happiness. Deep happiness. You should love the Huskers. You should. But not with such a weight of love that if they go 0-5, a real happiness is taken from you. It's about love in its right proportions. See, here's the thing. Wherever we put the most love, whatever the object of that love is, if we're ultimately going to be happy in some sustainable way, then that object of love, it can't be so temporal. It can't be the sort of thing that we can lose. Because the minute we can lose it, or the minute that it can be taken away from us against our will, then fear creeps in, grief creeps in. It can't be something that we can lose. And so it has to be outside of the temporal world. That only leaves one thing. It's God. This is what Augustine says about it. He says, to pursue God is to desire happiness. And to attain God is happiness itself. To pursue God is to desire happiness, and to attain Him, to have Him, is happiness itself. What I worry about is a church full of unhappy Christians. And this is the only way that I can make sense of how that works. It's a room full of people that they have faith, and they got love, and they've got salvation, and maybe they have assurance of salvation. You say, man, they got all that. Why aren't they happy? Because maybe they've settled too easily. They've been willing to settle for the gifts of God, the good things of God, His salvation, His grace. Maybe they've attained all that, but they have yet to attain God Himself. I worry about religion that will settle for going to heaven and not continue to be hungry for God Himself. If you want to be happy, the weight of your love, the drive of your life, has to find its object in God, because He's the only thing that really satisfies. He's the only thing you can't lose. Death cannot take Him away. And so until we have Him, there's going to be something missing. Church, when we get Him. It doesn't matter what life throws at us. Loss, grief, disappointment, despair. If we have Him, peace, joy, hope, contentment, happiness. We got to get those loves sorted out. And He's got to find His way to the top, where we hardly see anything else but Him. He has to get that big in our life if we want to be happy. Church, I'm glad that we're ending this morning with communion. If we weren't planning on it this morning, we would have done it. Because it's at this table that God does offer His good gifts, His gifts of grace and love and all that. But it's more than that, church. God offers Himself. This is the heart of God. To give Himself to us for our joy and for our happiness. This is My body. For you. And My blood. For you.